The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania Breds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our racehorse development fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void where prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
We're back at the races about 8 minutes after the top of the hour. Sid Fernando at the Lexington Keeneland sale, and 2 days in, the numbers have been stunning. And, of course, a lot of conversation about the announced Jockey Club proposal to limit the size of stallions' books. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale. Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Sid, trip out there, no problems? Did you bike out there?
No, I had the last couple of years, but I just decided to fly out this year because I didn't want to punish my body anymore.
Well, you're up and down the coast all winter, and yeah, I hear you.
Right.
I hear you. Well, there's a lot to digest here, and I would prefer to start with the sale, but I think in terms of storylines, proposal by the Jockey Club. I think we have to start there and, you know, get your reaction and what you think the motivations are, what the potential benefits could be, what the unintended consequences might be, and also what kind of reaction you've heard so far in the last 4 days.
Well, it's been a big topic of conversation here, no question about that. I haven't really given, you know, my opinion on this. I've been asked about it quite a bit. Before it came out, Jim Gagliano at the Jockey Club had told me, like, the day before it was going to come out, and it was just going to be a, sort of a question-and-answer type of period to get feedback from people, which is probably the best way to go. I mean, they're not just unilaterally, you know, putting down some kind of law that this is going to take place. So there's a dialogue that's been opened about it. You know, in general, and I kind of hinted at this on Twitter and a couple of tweets when it did come out, you have to look at what's happened in a historical perspective, which is we've gone from owner-breeders, mostly at the top of the business, transitioning over a 50-year period to mostly people that are breeding to sell, the commercial breeders. And actually, to put a cherry on the top of this thing, the Phippses, who were the last major owner breeders, this year are selling their colts in the sale. So it's almost kind of appropriate that that exclamation mark is there. This year, the year that the Jockey Club decided to do this. But when it was an owner-breeder game, you had 32 share syndicates. You had smaller books, and it kept organically book size down. Now, I do think that the more stallions you have, the more diversity you do have in the breed. So when it was in that type of format, it just happened organically. It's kind of jarring to hear, you know, that the Jockey Club has this proposal. And they're, obviously their motives are to create more diversity, and they're, I guess, worried about the health of the breed. This was the argument that was used when the Trotters, the U.S. TTA, did a similar thing, capping it at 140 mares a year. The difference between the two is that Trotters are artificial insemination, so theoretically a stallion could impregnate 1,000 mares, and they have a much smaller population, and that would be a much bigger percentage of it. So you can see the reasoning behind it. I'm sure everybody knows in the thoroughbred business, it's absolutely mandated live covers. Artificial insemination is not allowed. And so they're, you know, I think you've probably maxed out how many live, how many mares a stallion can serve in the Northern Hemisphere, which is probably where we're at right now. At that 250 mark, it's maybe more, but, you know, that's how it is in Japan, too, at the top of the market. So the bottom line is there are a couple of things I'll quickly address to you, Steve, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of them is that, and I mentioned this to Jim yesterday, too, in a text message that, you know, one of the things I said, I hadn't really fully formulated my ideas on this, but off the top of my head, you're going to depress stallion, the prices of stallions. When you depress the price of stallions here and in Japan, they're operating under a rule of no cap. Essentially, what you're going to do is give an advantage to the Japanese to be able to outbid Americans on horses. And, of course, when you think about what happened with Sunday Silence and what he did in Japan, and he was a Halo, son of Halo, and we don't really, except for More Than Ready, we don't have that line here. How, you know, we lost a major line that could have added a lot of diversity to, if that's what you're looking for. You could have, you know, you stand the chance of losing horses like that by handcuffing guys here and having the rest of the world, particularly Japan, operate under a different set of rules. So that was something I did throw to him. And it's something to consider as well. I thought another perspective in today's TDN, Tanya Gunther, the Gunthers, of course, bred Justified. They have some interesting comments in the TDN about letting market forces, you know, dictate, which is the argument that people who are against the cap pretty much say. So that's one aspect of it that's concrete that I could tell you about the depressing the stallion market.
From a glance, and you know, and I had Matt Hegarty Monday talk about the nuts and bolts of it, of the proposal. I also heard from some people that said that to some degree they would have preferred if the Jockey Club had made this just a unilateral action, that they just go ahead and did it and not try to, you know, gain some sort of a consensus, which has proven difficult in virtually every aspect of the industry. Some of the people that I talk to that, you know, that are in the trade and that are involved either as stallion farms or as commercial breeders or even as private breeders, they said that they would adjust to whatever, you know, that they don't have an objection to it. As Hegarty pointed out, it's only three dozen or so stallions that are even above the 140 now. And as I asked Rob Whiteley yesterday, you know, and Rob really, I think Rob was speaking very much for the, you know, the authentic breeders, the mare owners that have, you know, a collection of, they don't even have to be boutique-y mares. They don't even have to be, you know, the absolute best of the best, but, you know, are quality mares that, you know, people, you know, I always talk about Bo Lane, for instance. You know, somebody that's got an ongoing commitment to the game and the quality of the breed. You know, those are the backbone of the industry. I mean, the Rob Whiteleys and the Tom Evanses, et cetera. If there is a limit, the few hundred covers that are above now, they would be distributed, Sid, ostensibly to what? To like the middle tier, to the group that are covering, you know, 80 to 120 mares now. And isn't there potential for get them some better mares that would then, you know, potentially ignite or you know, reboot some stallion careers?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you know, the idea of having more stallions in circulation is certainly a much better idea. I mean, it's a great idea in terms of diversity, in terms of a lot of things, in terms of opportunity. You know, the game has become so concentrated with the major stallion entities kind of at the top, controlling most of these big stallions that do bleed over that figure. But, for example, if you use a horse like Into Mischief as an example, and Spencer's obviously would be against it, because if you look on that list, Into Mischief was the number one sire in the number of mares bred. You just you know, I think Matt Haggerty pointed this out. If you knock him down to 140, you're on paper value, basically you're taking $15 million off the table in potential income for that horse. A horse that they had started off you know, 7,500, got him all the way to 150, and as they're about to, that Horatio Alger story of making your way to the top, finally getting where the big boys are, and now you're trying to make some money, and they tell you, well, we're taking your $15 million off the top. I can understand that point of view, and in fact, I was talking to Gary West yesterday, Keeneland. Gary West has several young stallions at stud and coming to stud, and he's against it, as is B. Wayne Hayes, obviously. It's been publicized about that. But in terms of keeping a cap, you know, And the net effect of having more stallions in play, I think that's a fine idea. But like I said, it's very hard for me to comment on it since I can see points of view on both sides, and I'm just trying to at this point address some of the most glaring things that could happen and what would be some of the answers to that. In time, I think, Steve, I'll probably be able to give you a more cogent, cohesive analysis of this, but it kind of just happened. And just to speak off the top, I don't think it's fair right now.
All right. Well, I also would love to hear from, and I've got to solicit suggestions from you regarding, you know, an equine, you know, a geneticist or whatever, a genome, whatever the studies, whatever the appropriate.
TDM,
I'm curious.
Just asked me for one, and I just shook my I really don't know. And, in fact, I was having a big conversation yesterday with Alan Porter and Byron Rogers on the sales grounds, you know, with this whole idea of, the diversity and if there's too much inbreeding. And the example I pointed out to them was two things. I said, look, if Coolmore is breeding Danehill mares to Galileo, you're inbreeding a lot of Northern Dancer. And if they keep winning and they're beating everybody else, who's to tell them not to do that? You know?
Yeah.
And the second part about it is, if you're trying to do this for the health of the breed, and so For the sake of example, using Galileo, say there's a son of Galileo, and you want to cap him at a certain number of mares. Well, then, say an entity like Coolmore may have 10 other sons of Galileo for you to move your other mares to. So,
well,
what are you doing? You're moving them to other Galileos.
I appreciate you bringing that in, and certainly, you know, not that Tappet himself is overbred, because he covers 110, 115 a year, but you've got all these sons of Tappet. And, you know, one of the things I asked Haggerty, if you look at the breeding at the stallion wheel, and all the, you know, the various sire lines. I mean, the cow's well out of the barn on this front, Sid. Right? I mean, we're not going to revive. We're not going to go find obscure, you know, ACAC line stallions to try to revive a you know, portions of you know, of moribund breeding lines.
But occasionally they pop up. Like, for example, Uncle Mo appeared. And he's from the Carroll line, which had been dormant for a long time, and he appeared. And so he's come, you know, there's only a certain number. The thoroughbred is closed. So there's only certain lines in there. And organically, what will happen is something will pop up that's not, that's historically how things have happened. Uncle Mo is a recent example. But, for example, if you were to take a horse like Hillendale's Bayern, who's by Awfully Wild, the Wild Again line, which has been very, very dormant, if this horse hits, suddenly you have another kind of sire line that's not part of Capit or AP Indy or even a Stern Cat or something like that. And ultimately, over periods of time, certain lines just fade out. If you look in the beginning of the modern era when Sir Galahad was imported by Bull Hancock and a syndicate, son of Teddy, and this Teddy line really blew up, then E. Dale Schaefer of Coltrane Stud brought over his full brother Bulldog. Then you had Bull Lee, who had the Citation, and it looked for a while like the Teddy line was going to overtake everything and become all-encompassing, and then it died out. There's not a single Teddy line horse basically around now noteworthy. So we're in the midst of something here with, say, AP Indy, but that AP Indy line is obviously proliferated through Tappet. And you have a few of his sons around. But after Tappet, where's it going to go? It may disappear down the road. It's not as vibrant. In Europe, you have Galileo, and that's been dominant. In Australia, you have various Dane Hill riding horses, and practically everything in Australia has Dane Hill in it now. So, these are issues that usually bite themselves out. And as I pointed to Alan, Alan Porter, I said, who's going to be the guy that says, who's going to be the experiment that says, well, we need to do something else here. And so you go away from beating to the most successful line just because you want to, add diversity or something. And then you suffer. So nobody's going to do that. Everybody's going to go with, what's winning kind of thing. So it's a complex issue. It's an issue that's surrounded by a lot of dollars behind it. And essentially, it's going to be tough to, although the motives are excellent, it's going to be tough to fully legislate and fully regulate. And so that's why, if you don't mind, I'll take a few more weeks to formulate this whole thing.
Fair enough. And I sense that a lot of the, a lot of the most prominent stakeholders are also, taking that tact. And obviously they've got their agendas and they've got their hands full at the sale. But I find this discussion, just fascinating. And at some point, we'll pick it up. Well, I also want you to pick it up regarding, how some of those, some of those areas, you mentioned the Teddy, for instance, you and I can't remember the last time we brought up, Phalaris versus non-Phalaris, and and how much of those, there are those areas that are still basically, I guess, alive through broodmares, and it's one of the reasons why you hear people talk about, having. Seeking out Graustark mares and in reality line mares, that have some of that. When you and I talk outcrosses the blending of modern fashionable pedigree from a sire line side with what might be the more robust less commercial female families, and that's where that gets in. It's Yeah, I mean, it's something that I'm captivated by, and I hope people don't mind that I've spent 3 days. I mean, I've had this topic, at the fore between Matt's report and then Rob Whiteley yesterday, and a real pleasure to hear from Rob yesterday, and I knew we would hear from you. So, all right, let's turn our attention to some sale results and some things to look forward to in this third day of book one. Some initial impressions, Sid, obviously the Hillendale, who sponsors us, and we're proud to be affiliated. Curlin much as he did at Saratoga, just amazing yesterday.
Curlin, been the story of this whole sales season. They seem, off the top of my head, they seem to be averaging well over 800,000.
Yep.
For the year, including the two sales that David Tipton are coming into now, Curlin stands for $175,000, which made him the third most expensive stallion this year, behind Warfront and Tappet. And he's certainly the type of horse that has become a go-to for everybody in this country who are looking for those classic horses. And, it's ironic that he's exploding this year. This is the first year that he didn't have a colt winner place, a classic race, a winner place in a classic race in the United States. Every year since he'd been to stud, he'd had that. But that cumulative effect, people understand that. And the prices are there behind him. He's got Stone Street, his principal owner, supporting him heavily. This is a case where you and I was giving an example of sometimes the stallion owner is also the commercial breeder.
Right.
In this particular case, Stone Street, you see what they do. They brought all their colts to auction except the one, which was the Curlin Rachel's Valentina for sentimental reasons. But that was scratched. But all their colts are here to sell. And, with the type of Brugner band behind them, they, as the stallion owner, are reaping the benefits of selling these well-bred mares, these yearlings by well-bred mares at Bold Curlin. And let's see here. 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, I'm just looking here from yesterday's session. You had the $4.1 million colt that was the Stone Street, the one out of Bounding, obviously. And the third highest price out of Dreaming of Julia, again for Stone Street. Two of the three most expensive lots were Curlin, and both from Barbara Bankey's operation.
And which is quite an accomplishment, at any sale, let alone this one, to have the top, we'll see about today, I guess, the American Pharoah, Leslie's Lady Filly, the sister to Beholder, the half to Beholder, and Mendelssohn, and Into Mischief, the whole Leslie's Lady story is quite remarkable. So we'll see what this one fetches, but hard to believe. It's a little hard to conceive that somebody's going to top the $4.1 million between now and, we do get occasional book two and book three, seven-figure flare-ups, but this is the sale topper, no?
You would have to think so, but then this was the highest priced horse since 2010. When Mr. Bezzy Lou made $4.2 million. So we're starting to get into some serious prices that we haven't seen here in a while. And the American Pharoah Leslie's Lady as a filly is going to be a beautiful filly, and she's going to be extremely desirable because she's out of that Broodmare of the Year. With the siblings you just pointed out. And, you know, who knows what that'll be. What you have right now is you have Sheikh Mohammed. Sheikh Mohammed bought 3 of the $5 million lots yesterday, and his brother Shadwell, Sheikh Hamdan, bought the other two. So all 5 $7 million horses were purchased by either Sheikh Mohammed or Sheikh Hamdan. They're bidding, particularly Godolphin is bidding against Coolmore. So it's one of the interesting things is two entities bidding against each other, which is something that's been missing lately at these sales because, Steve, as we pointed out, you have so many different partnerships now that are joining forces instead of bidding against each other. And, of course, that will depress prices, but when you have two well-known entities bidding against each other, it's reminiscent of the old sales fireworks.
Very much, and you know, you mentioned the partnerships that that have teamed up, and that includes China Horse Club working with Windstar under the Maverick Racing. We've seen quite a bit from Vinnie Viola, Micropoli, and Coolmore, etc. Sid, I find it irresistible to bring this up. You know, considering, and you mentioned Tanya Gunther's comments. The Gunthers have very notably had RNAs with Justify siblings,
right,
the last 2 years. It's funny how certain people seem to be saying when it comes to the potential for the limiting the covers of the stallions, they say, free market conditions should prevail, except when it suits them to not have market conditions prevail. You can't really have it both ways. If you want market conditions to rule the day, well, then you can't be setting reserves. And then by all rights, shouldn't the Vinnie Violas, Micropolis, and MV Magners of the world be competing against each other to buy horses, as opposed to changing the market conditions by teaming up? This is really... It kind of a funny. I said this to Rob yesterday too, or to Matt. It seems very funny that the kinds of people that typically call for a limit of government involvement, in commerce, when it suits them, they're quite happy to put limitations on the commerce.
That's an interesting. It's so tangled for me to go through that one, but
ostensibly but you agree.
I can see the point you're making, but it's like I said to you before. You know, ordinarily the Gunthers, most people in the Gunthers' position would have sold a will take charge for whatever it was last year, $1.5 million or whatever they bought it back for. But, you know, ultimately what has happened with the sales is that the proportion of people that are selling within this industry has increased dramatically versus the proportion of people that used to breed and race. So what's happened now is that, and this is true, by the way, when you look at tracks, the bigger tracks are the ones that are succeeding and the smaller ones are receding. Essentially, what that's saying is that this is becoming the game of kings again. In other words, it's the top. The top of the market is where everything's happening. And if that's going to be the case, it's going to shrink. The industry is going to shrink because the bottoms... the bottom adds diversity, the bottom adds more players, but the bottom has been neglected by the industry at large, whether it's racetracks, whether it's the small breeders, whether it's the mid-level breeders like Rob, who you had the other day, who got absolutely punished during the economic meltdown of 2007-2008. That particular worldwide event wiped out so much of the middle out, and that created an entirely new hierarchy where the bottom then became the middle. And so a lot of what people are, you know, trying to find solutions for without really thinking things through is a response to the reshaking, the kaleidoscopic change that's taken place in this industry is very hard to address without looking at all segments of this industry. And if you just try to take, in this case, just the breeding element here, or in the racing case, this Integrity Act with Lasix alone, or in the case of what Santa Anita does with the Jerry Hollendorfer as a villain, you know, we're all, these guys are all just addressing small components of something without knowing how to holistically address the disease. And that's what's missing in this industry, is that we don't have people that look at the entire issue and say, well, everything's related to everything else, and and you want to do this here, and you want to do this. And so there's no real foresight, Steve.
And if it, and if there is, it's very difficult to, if there, you know, when it does exist, and there are certainly people that, you know, that are willing to commit and offer solution or proactive courses of action. And I can, I'll use Satish as, you know, the most glaring recent example. Instead of it, especially when it seemed like there was a coalition built to adopt the plan that Satish was forwarding, and then at the last minute, individual specific portions, it started to unravel when self-interest basically reared its head. And the entire sport is an organic entity and is interdependent, and that unfortunately it just doesn't get it doesn't get appreciated for that aspect. And it also should be, as you just pointed out, it should also be brought forth as one of the reasons why it is so difficult to affect, you know, widespread change in the game. And also the game is also a victim of its age too. And it's the culture and the way in which the sport evolved, and that includes, the 37 jurisdictions. I mean, because racing predates everybody says, oh, we should be like baseball and football. Yeah, except that they're barely 100 years old, I mean, the NFL is celebrating this supposed 100th year, which is phony because they really didn't start in 1919. They really didn't start till 1933. They're probably worried that they're not going to be around in 2033. To celebrate the 100th anniversary. But, racing's been around since the 1700s. And racing associations, they started to formally be created in the 1800s. And what we have now is an outgrowth of that. And the individual entities, the way it grew, it's there's nothing else like it. And trying to roll back the clock is daunting.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues here that need to be addressed, and it's really, take a put it on a dartboard and start throwing darts, you know, at it, because you're going to hit your target no matter where you throw it.
Well, what do they say? Act locally and think globally. I don't know.
Yeah.
Take care of, you know, whatever is right in front of you. Hey, well, this, frankly, Sid, doesn't this all get back to the discussion over the winter of being good stewards of the game? And if everybody approached it with that in mind, and legitimately, you know, practiced that as their watchword, you wouldn't have some of these intractable issues that, you know, that seem impossible to move and impossible to solve. But if everybody, you know, if everybody had the game's interest instead of self-interest in mind, we would accomplish a lot more. Meanwhile, some of that self-interest includes selling of yearlings. What do you like of what you've seen so far? And of course, when we get to books two and three, a lot more of the first crop stallions will get their chance. Some of the less heralded ones, you know, clearly Frosted and Nyquist and Run Happy, they've, in the first couple of days, they've been California Chrome. He's got, I think, four today or more. Talk about some of the first crop action.
Well, Run Happy has been, you know, he's a Claiborne horse, and he's getting the type of response he gets. He's probably the young horse, and he didn't stand for a lot of money, relatively speaking. He's extremely popular, and I think you're going to find that when the dust settles, he'll probably be a horse by leading average among the first yearlings. An interesting horse that has gotten a lot of play at the sale that you wouldn't have expected it is Union Rags. Union Rags started off promisingly when his first crop was only three. He had an outstanding record of four grade one winners with his oldest runners only three, which is just phenomenal when you think about it. And at that time, if you compared him to the auction darling Into Mischief, Into Mischief at that time had only three grade one winners with several more crops, and Union Rags had four with only two. Now Into Mischief now has five. Union Rags has remained at four, and if Catalina Cruiser wins one this year, it'll be five. But that shows you that this horse is a tremendous potential to get grade one horses, even though they haven't been consistent. Well, he's had three horses that have sold, and, you know, we're talking about a $60,000 stud fee. He's had a filly that brought $1 million and two colts. One of them was the Phipps colt that was named already, Barbuda. But two colts brought $750,000 and $725,000 just yesterday. So, that's a pretty serious return, obviously, on investment. And he's a horse that I think if you're sharp, you should keep an eye on him, because people are catching on to him right now at this moment.
Interesting, and that's one of the things that you want. You want to go against the tide a little bit, and hit them where they ain't.
Yeah, exactly. And here's a case where this horse is a young enough horse, and he's done well enough, and he's had two very good maiden 2-year-old winners this year too. But he was kind of below the radar, but it's interesting that people are beginning to, everybody has their analysts and they put the pencil to paper and they figured it out, because, he's obviously getting those type of horses. And if you look at the leading sires, and you expect the Curlin, Warfront Curlin, then suddenly Union Rag, Warfront, you know, Curlin, Tappet, Union Rag. So that's good. Flatter, by the way, another horse, $40,000 sub fee at Claiborne. He had a $900,000 colt, which is a
Larry Best.
Big
well,
hit.
You get Larry Best to show up. That'll help.
Yeah, exactly. Interesting among these other horses, all to be expected. Pioneer of Denial, of course, is dead now. He had two for six. 625 and 610. And then among the new horses, the most expensive was Frosted at 600, which you kind of mentioned. But Into Mischief, he's got a bunch in his sale. And some other, Frosted had another one at 425. But it's mostly the same players, except for Frosted busting into the top this year. But I have a feeling Run Happy will eclipse him by the time it's over, even though Frosted entered stud for twice.
I also was tracking. I take that Pinhook guide out of the TDN every day, and then go back and look and see what kind of returns some of the weanling or some of the short yearling purchases got. And there was one early yesterday. I bring it up, Sid, because it was a Union Rags, and Dromoland offered Hip 202, the Union Rag mm-hmm. colt out of Zondak, was a $390,000 short yearling purchase. In January at the Keeneland sale, and fetched $750 from Shadwell yesterday.
Yeah. The thing with the Union Rag, if you recall him, he was a big, good-looking horse. I mean, a big horse. And so he's going to give you the type of yearling that you want to see. The physical is so important at these sales, and he delivers a big physical for you. So he... it's not surprising that they'd be popular in there, but I think more so people are beginning to catch on to him. That's an interesting example.
Well, today we look forward to closing out the book. And then, you know, to some degree, I mean, I think we know, Sid, that you know, book one and to a large extent book two, it's going to be the, you know, the headline grabbers and the seven figure sellers and so forth. But when we get to the, you know, middle of next week, the books three, four, and five, you know, that's where it gets fun. And you get to really, you got to be on your toes.
Yeah, you really do. And you'll see, right? Like you said, you'll see a lot of the new horses. I mean, let's give him credit where it's due. The biggest new horse so far through the first two sessions was Frosted by a mile. I mentioned the 600,000. I think he had five selling. I think the lowest was 380. Now his stud fee was 50. He's a Godolphin horse. He's a Darley horse. But he's got a lot in his sale, and once you get past him, you're going to run into Run Happy, and you're going to run into all the other young horses, California Chrome, like you said. You're going to get some surprises down the road, and you're absolutely right. That's when it becomes a lot of fun to watch what happens.
Now, how long are you staying? You're going to stay through book two?
No, I'm going. I'm actually leaving tomorrow. I just stayed for the first three sessions, and then, you know, I have to get back. It's funny at the sale, because you get there the first day, you run into all these people, you shake hands, and but it's too much exposure. And then you run into them that afternoon. You see them again the next morning. By the end of the second day, you walk past the same guy that you've had such warm hugs with in the beginning, and you just look away from that guy. You don't even talk to him. And by the third day, it's like, Jesus, that guy again. And so I think it's always good to just get the hell out while the going's good. And the feelings are warm. You know what I mean?
That's so good. I love it. Well, later in the sale, we'll catch up. John Secura. John didn't want to visit ahead of the first couple of days. So we'll get some thoughts from John as things unfold further.
John and I were across the aisle from each other on the first day, and we both did the right thing. We looked at each other. We acknowledged each other from across the aisle, said a couple of words, and then we looked away and kept that brief.
Well, nobody's looking away from the Curlins. Yesterday, as amazing a day as a stallion can have in the ring, every single horse that he produced there that went through the ring yesterday, every single one sold, no RNAs, and that was what, eight, that wasn't a four, eight, that was 10 offerings out of 10,
yeah.
And the day before, there were two RNAs the day before, one for 75,000 and one for 190, but Curlin basically it's been his year, and kind of overpowering the sales here since we left Saratoga. Sid, I appreciate it. We'll look forward to some more thoughts, and we'll have plenty more to analyze when we talk next week.
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks. I'll talk to you next week.
Sid Fernando, and a reminder, everybody, as we get into the fourth quarter of the year, if you've got a new stallion, if you're out in any regional breeding program and anywhere in the country, you are going to want to get your stallion enrolled in the Enix system, and you got to get that work done ahead before. You really should do it now because people are starting to poke around and they're putting their mare's name in, trying to plan matings. So get a hold of Sid and the team at Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. And work with Sid, and they'll do. Now's the time to be doing your broodmare compatibility analysis, and let Sid go over your produce records and help you get your runner or your sale prospect. Either way, we're actually getting close to 11. Let's take the break here. We'll come back for hour three, and we'll start with Bill Downs at Indiana Grand. We'll talk about last weekend, the DQ that cost Jimmy Baker, and the four stakes today. You got an all-stakes pick four, Indiana Breds, and it's a nice sequence. There's also a very good maiden race where you might have a commissioner today. Two-year-old fillies going five on the turf. And Queen of Verona caught my eye for John Ortiz, who's had a very solid meet. He's debuting a commissioner filly out of a four-stree mare. She was a Keeneland November $20,000 purchase. And commissioner, his debuters have been ridiculous, 8-1. Bill Downs joins us next.